This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, welcome to The Country Hour. I'm Cassie Help with you today. It's been a bit more rain over the weekend. I hope it got to where it was needed. It might have made you think a little bit about fertiliser, and there are a lot of considerations when it comes to fertiliser output, and it's not just the season or the cost. Increasing focus is being placed on the nitrous oxide emissions as well.
Whether it's for these market access or potential mandate issues, in terms of improving the way we use our inputs, the biggest benefit is to the bottom line in terms of improving crop production.
I'll take a look at some of the things farmers are considering when it comes to carbon and the carbon effect from fertiliser. Also, sunflower demand is skyrocketing due to the massive shortfall out of Ukraine. South Australia doesn't produce a lot of sunflowers, but this year it might be the year to give it a go. So I'll have more on that soon. But not great news out of the wool market after the winter recess. Pretty frosty reception. The Eastern Market Indicator dropped 45 cents and pass-in rates were high. Continuing uncertainty with China amid its zero COVID policy and a strong Aussie dollar contributed to the bad week. Josh Lamb from Endeavour Exports ran Eliza Burlage through the latest.
It was a pretty ordinary week last week for the wool market after a three-week recess. We were expecting that, but most Micron groups gave up sort of around that 40 to 50 cents a kilo, so a little bit of a rocky start to the new season, but not unexpected either.
Did anything in particular sort of stand out having a better week than the rest?
Not really. It was pretty much red ink across the board, you know, from fine wools all the way through to coarse crossbred. So, yeah, it was a market that showed signs of a little bit of weakening demand, which is normal for this time of year, and an appreciating Aussie dollar against the US. So, yeah, no, there was nothing good to talk about really, except the week ended.
There was also quite a bigger offering, quite a lot in storage as well. Is that likely to move in the next few weeks or still a bit slow?
Well, pass-in rates were quite high at different stages last week, particularly for Merino fleece. They're in the sort of 40 to 50% range at some points during the auction. But, you know, we offered just under 60,000 bales. We do get big sales at this time of year, particularly coming out of a recess. The quantities have dropped off around 20% for this week and they'll drop off again next week. And, you know, traditionally in early September, we do run out of a little bit of wool, the market will stabilise a little bit, hopefully, and we'll get a bit better direction. But yeah, there's certainly growers are keen to sell, I think, for a myriad of reasons.
And of course, you know, always a big question, what's been happening with China?
They're a little bit quiet, even for this time of year. We expect them not to be too interested in buying wool in the middle of their summer, which they're at the moment. But, you know, they've still got problems locally there with their zero COVID policy, and that's definitely the biggest effect we're seeing on that is it's knocking confidence around with our clients to put their toe in the water for later in the season. So that's the biggest effect we're seeing at the moment out of it. I think the local economy is definitely struggling there with the government, you know, still randomly locking down provinces and cities. But the biggest issue we're seeing, it's really, really hurting confidence.
Josh Lamb from Endeavour speaking with Eliza Burlage there. Hopefully things turn around a bit this week. To cropping now, and there's a lot of focus at the moment on the greenhouse gas emissions and the sources of them, including in the ag sector. In broadacre cropping, fertiliser production and use accounted for about 58% of the Australian wheat crop's greenhouse gas footprint in the last 5 years. That's according to the Department of Agriculture, and much of that relates to nitrogen fertiliser. So if you're a user of nitrogen and you're concerned about the associated nitrous oxide emissions, what can you do to reduce those emissions? Angus Verley spoke with James Murray, who is a senior researcher at the Birchip Cropping Group, about some of his ideas.
I guess naturally the go-to option is to grow more legumes, so we're not applying as much nitrogen in a synthetic capacity. There is greenhouse gases as nitrous oxide associated with the breakdown of legume stubble, so they certainly add to it as well, but they go a long way to starting to reduce that footprint.
And I suppose agronomically, from a disease perspective, etc., there is a limit on how much you can put pulses into the system?
Theoretically, within a farming system, you max out at 50% of area grown to legumes because you would need to go back to canola or wheat the following year. 50% is a high-risk strategy in terms of production as well. So the reality in the definitely in the Mallee environment, and perhaps the Wimmera is probably a 33%, so one in every 3 years.
Okay, so that's one option, growing more legumes, but there are other products on the market now.
Yeah, so one is a urease inhibitor, so reduces that volatilisation risk by slowing that release when you apply if you don't get follow-up rainfall relatively quickly. The other ones are sort of polymer coatings, which actually slow the release of nitrogen and the availability to the plant quite significantly. The challenge with them at the minute is they're not necessarily cost-effective to utilise. So the urease inhibitors, for example, retailing for about $50 a tonne on top of your normal urea costs. So it opens up a question about how cost-effective that is in the farming system, I suppose.
And is there an agronomic or yield benefit from them at all? Or if you're going down that path, is it purely because you want to reduce your greenhouse gas footprint?
There certainly is. When conditions are conducive to high levels of volatilisation, which I should mention isn't common in southern Australia, just given the cool and generally wet winters that we have. But if there is periods of time that are conducive to volatilisation, there can be a productive benefit around utilising some of these. And they've come into vogue a bit this year with really high urea prices, is small amounts of losses that actually hit your bottom line a fair bit. It's probably a question for the future where they fit around, I guess, business as usual with these coatings on top or not. Probably at the moment it's more that social license sort of situation at present.
If you're not going to go down this coatings path, and if you are just using regular old urea, how much option though is there still to reduce your greenhouse gas footprint by just using that urea more efficiently?
Yeah, if we are just using normal urea to boost our nitrogen levels in our soil and for our crops, the most efficient way we can do that is going to have a massive benefit for crop production and the economics at the end of the day. So we talk a bit about the four R's, so the right rate, the right product, the right source, and the right timing to, just make sure that the nitrogen we are applying is as efficient and available to that crop as possible, which at the end of the day, we'll have really significant benefits for just crop production, full stop. And if we're reducing our greenhouse gas footprint at the same time, that's only a bonus, isn't it?
I suppose anecdotally, James, the perception may be that a lot of farmers aren't particularly concerned about their greenhouse gas footprint. But from your experience, the people you speak with, what would you say to that?
I think the attitude's definitely starting to shift. I've been in the industry 10 years, and I'd say when I came in, you'd bang on the money there. But yeah, I think in the last probably 2 or 3 years, there's been a conscious shift in thinking about this sort of stuff and what impact you're having on the environment. And I guess it's not solely from a feel-good type perspective. There's considerations around market access and futuristic sort of mandates on how things are utilised. There's an example out of New Zealand recently where nitrogen applications in New Zealand are essentially mandated by the government on what and when and how much and so on. So whether Australia marches down that path, I probably have a big question mark of whether we would actually ever get there, but it's not too far away from our doorstep, I guess.
And that's a good point. I think that story being replicated in Canada and the Netherlands to some extent. So how much do you think farmers are looking at that and thinking, well, I really need to get ahead of the game here in case there is some potential mandate that's handed down and I'm caught flat-footed?
Yeah, it's definitely a consideration, particularly from the early adopters amongst us, to really consider it. The challenge for the industry as a whole is, I suppose, the unknown of it, not really knowing what any of those mandates may look like. I think a really good example is the canola industry in terms of sending grain to the EU and all the associated environmental conditions that need to be met there, that growers have been pretty good at ensuring that they're meeting them. So the future's bright when it comes to any mandates we have. So I think it's a great opportunity for the Australian grains industry to be ahead of the game on this sort of stuff. And as I mentioned earlier, whether it's for these market access or potential mandate issues, in terms of improving the way we use our inputs, the biggest benefit is to the bottom line in terms of improving crop production.
James Murray, Senior Research Manager at Birchip Cropping Group, speaking with Angus Verley. And while we're on the topic of emissions, the hype around methane-reducing seaweed until now has focused on how it could help the livestock industry meet net zero emissions. But now there's a new trial to examine the effect of Asparagopsis on pregnant cows and their offspring. University of Adelaide's Dr. Mariana Catano, who's leading the study, tells Eliza Berlage about this project that's focusing on the dairy industry.
So we want to determine and evaluate the effect on the progeny. So when they are born, if they will perform in the same way. And the reason is we will evaluate the effects of the seaweed on ruminal microbiome of pregnant cows and also its impact on microbial population of the progeny at birth and around weaning. They start producing methane.
What does that look like? Is that looking at whether the pregnant cows are able to still provide enough nutrition when they're eating this seaweed? And then is that also looking at whether this changes the amount of methane produced by their offspring because of the way that their mother has been eating this product?
Yeah, it's more like every time that we feed animals with any feed with anti-methanogenic properties, most likely these seeds, they will impact in the ruminal microbiome, so the microorganisms in the rumen of these animals. And once you change the population of microorganisms, when you have neonatal calves, their microorganisms in the gut will be established by mum. So it can either come from oral cavity, vaginal, or even fecal matter. And for that reason, if we are changing the microorganisms in the rumen of pregnant cows, that may also change the microorganisms established in neonatal calves, and that can impact their growth rate and also immunological response. So for that reason, we will investigate that just to detect if we will have any beneficial effect on them, and how they will perform not only like at birth, but also around weaning and later in life.
How will this project actually work in practice?
Okay, so we wanted to calibrate a low-cost or handheld device to be used on farm. So we will have the methane data measured by green feed machines that most researchers use nowadays. But also we will have a measurement of methane production by an infrared device that can be adopted on farm in the future, hopefully. So by the end of this trial, what we want is to recommend an affordable tool that most producers can adopt on farm to measure carbon abatement in livestock. So the calibration that we will perform during this trial will be valuable for producers, not only for mitigation strategies, but also for genetic selection purposes.
What's the timeline for this project? When are you hoping to get started?
Okay, so we aim to start this trial towards the end of this year. So we are now identifying producers that they have a pregnant cow. So then towards the end of this year, we will supplement low-dose seaweed to pregnant cows late gestation. So then we will have a lot of measurements more towards the beginning of 2023, and we should have finished this trial towards mid next year. So hopefully we will be able to share some valuable data for producers to make decisions in the future.
Are you aware of any similar studies being done before?
Yeah, there are a few studies, but they did use a different approach, either like that they start supplementing neonatal calves up to weaning, with the different anti-methanogenic compounds. We did as well in the past, like our group back in 2014-15, we did supplemented some pregnant cows as well, but we were using different approach. We were basically formulating different feeds, evaluating how much we could reduce methane emissions by supplementing those feeds and how they were performing. Now we just want to use a different approach and evaluate as well the progeny and see how they are performing later in life.
University of Adelaide's Head of Ruminant Nutrition Group, Dr. Mariana Catano, speaking with Eliza Berlage. It's 19 minutes past 12.
Know a young person from regional Australia with a story to tell? Let them know they can enter the ABC Haywire competition and tell it like it is.
I love being on the farm.
I'm learning English.
You matter. So does your mental health.
Entries can be a written story, an audio recording, or a video.
It is just as cool as it sounds.
Winners get their stories on the ABC and take part in the Haywire Regional Youth Summit.
Young people tell it like it is.
Enter now at abc.net.au/haywire.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Before we get to the weather, the nation's largest online platform for livestock sales, Auction Plus, has posted another set of record figures for the 2021-22 financial year, with gross sales hitting $3.5 billion, up 49% on the previous year. The online seller, which is jointly owned by Elders and Nutrien, continues to see increases in non-livestock commodities, with property sales up 139% and machinery and clearing sales increasing by 63%. Auctions Plus Chief Economist Tim McRae says the formula is working.
Get a lot more eyeballs and a lot more attention on their products when they're offered up. So, yeah, certainly some big results. And, you know, I think the best way to summarise it is one old timer has told me that Auctions Plus is his favourite TV station. He watches it every night.
That's fantastic. I know on a Friday, if ever you call a cattle cocky, there's clicking in the background. But let's look at land sales and machinery sales, because both those categories really jumped up.
The big increase in machinery and clearance sales, and, you know, that's a lot to do with the ability of the agents on the ground to be able to, you know, get producers to both be organised and get the pictures online and get the catalogues up. But, you know, we've certainly seen a lot of people now coming online every day. We can see and analyse a lot of the search terms that people put in. Whilst you might only buy livestock once or twice a year, there's a lot of people online who are always looking at what's in the catalogue, what can they find down the back shed without, you know, having to drive hundreds of kilometres in some instances to go to clearing sales or check properties out.
It's the sticky beak you can have without getting in the foot falcon. Now, I'm just looking at those figures. Property sales up 139%. Machinery and clearing sales increased by 63%. Goat numbers up too.
Yeah, goats is really, you know, I think it's a real sleeper in the industry. It's growing steadily. And you've only got to go back a couple of decades to, you know, see a lamb industry that it was a similar size of value of the industry. So, you know, one of the big changes we've seen is a lot of goats and sheep as well going back into southern Queensland. So I think the growth in the goat industry is only just gaining momentum, and I think we'll see that grow steadily in coming years.
Of course, the cattle contribution for Auctions Plus is huge. Do you have some of those numbers?
Yeah, look, core business for Auctions Plus is commercial cattle and sheep. And cattle, we just fell short of 900,000 head for the year, dominated by New South Wales and southern Queensland. We saw a big growth in stud cattle sales, and we're just about to hit our busy time of the year again with all our bull sales. But with these seasonal conditions we've had for the last 2 years, that's given producers flexibility. And with the Auctions Plus platform, you know, they don't have to leave the farm if the producer's not happy with the price. That's assisted by having additional feed in the paddock where they have the ability to wait and hold, and that's really what we're seeing in the market this week, producers waiting and holding till they get the price they like.
In terms of the numbers for Auctions Plus, do you foresee them jumping again? I mean, 49% on those previous figures is a huge jump. Can it get bigger?
The growth in the last 3 years has really been both a combination of people becoming familiar and comfortable with using the platform, and that growth will continue, I think. What we've also had is the COVID tailwinds of movement restrictions, and that certainly has helped introduce a lot of people to the platform. I think what we'll see, and what a real challenge for Auctions Plus is when seasonal conditions dry out and we hear the phrase, they've just got to go. When we see that, sale yards really benefit from that. But I think producers have really started to see the advantages of having more control over their sale price, and Auctions Plus gives them that. You know, set your reserve, watch what buyers are looking for, and be able to have more control on your product that you've put a lot of effort into. I think we'll still see that growth and that trend towards producers having more control on their sale in the years to come.
Tim McRae, a quick word on the cattle market. The Ecke jumped, as we just heard. That's, of course, the rolling average across the sale yards. What's your view on where it's going?
My view on where it's going is that producers who have cattle to sell are quite unhappy with where the price levels are at, and they have the ability to hold. They have a lot of feed in the paddock. Things are only going to warm up in the southern states, and in Queensland, there's only going to be more feed on the ground. So I think they're choosing to hold and hopefully see the market improve. I know online we've got our lowest numbers for the year at only 5,000 head. And, you know, if producers don't have to sell, they won't sell.
So, yeah, that's supply and demand ticking it up. But do you think further than that, there's more factors pushing to see it head north?
I think, you know, an EYCI in four figures is both, you know, unprecedented, but I think that signals a very high cattle market. I think, you know, into the early parts of next year, into the autumn of 2023, I think we'll see an EYCI back with an 8 in front of it, and that's a reflection of a bigger herd. And also, you know, we've had a pretty good run of wet conditions across a lot of areas. I think that luck will run out soon. We'll start to see the impact of a bigger cattle herd starting to hit the market.
Tim McRae, Chief Economist from Auctions Plus, speaking with Ali Felton-Taylor. It was a bit wet over the weekend in places. Senior forecaster Hannah Marsh has the latest on what's happening weather-wise. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie.
So it looks like it's going to be a bit of a drippy week this week. What's happening?
Yeah, it will be. We do have some isolated showers around associated with a trough today. We are seeing that activity at the moment. It will start to ease as we head into the evening period. There is just that little bit of instability, so there's a chance of seeing the odd strike or two about parts of Eastern Eyre Peninsula, possibly extending into the Flinders, the Mid-North and the Riverland as we head into the afternoon period. But as I mentioned, this system will be easing and moving out to the east. So as we head into tomorrow, we're looking at a cold day at first with early frost and fog patches, mainly about the northern agricultural area and the pastoral districts. It will be generally dry, but there's still the chance of seeing a spot or two in the southeast first thing in the morning as this system does move to the east. But also about the ranges, there could be some convection during the afternoon as well, but it won't amount to much in terms of rainfall totals. Otherwise, we're looking at a partly cloudy day about the south and sunny in the north, and it will be cool, grading to mild in the west and even warm in the far west of the state. We're looking at moderate southwesterly winds turning northerly in the west, and having a look at some temperatures for tomorrow, heading for 19 degrees and mostly sunny at Ceduna, 17 and mostly sunny for Whyalla, 18 at Woomera, 17 for Renmark, 14 and a shower or two for Mount Gambier, and looking at 13 with that possible shower at Clare. Then as we head into Wednesday, we've got a upper level cloud band that we're expecting to develop on Wednesday about the west coast and southern agricultural area. We're looking at showers developing during the day. As we head further north, just the chance of a spot or two as we head towards the late evening period. Winds generally, we're looking at light to moderate northerly. They will become fresh at times in the west, and that'll extend to central parts during the day. And the winds will turn southwesterly in the far west later with this system. Then the shower activity will push further north to the south of the pastoral districts on Thursday. There is also the chance of seeing some gusty thunderstorms about the southern agricultural area on Thursday with this front as it does move through. And then further shower activity expected on Friday, but it will start contracting to the agricultural area. And there is just the chance of seeing some small hail about the southeast on Friday as the peak of that cold air moves over the area. So having a look at cumulative rainfall totals until the end of Friday, we're looking at 2 to 10 millimetres over the northern agricultural area, 10 to 20 millimetres about the ranges, the southern agricultural area and parts of Eyre Peninsula. And then there is the possibility of local falls to 15 to 30 millimetres about southern coastal parts and also the Mount Lofty ranges. We are looking at it remaining dry across the north with less than 5 millimetres expected over southern parts of the pastoral districts. So as you mentioned, quite a wet period coming up, particularly further south, but Tuesday is really the only day where we're looking at generally fine conditions.
That's the day to do the washing. Looking at the temperatures, this wet weather's keeping the lows not so low, but the top temperatures are really quite low, even for this time of year, would you say?
Yeah, and particularly on Friday when the peak of that cold air does come over it, we are looking at those maximum temperatures even hovering through parts of the southeast around the 10, 11, 12 degree mark.
Yeah, so still in winter.
Absolutely. It's just that reminder, isn't it?
Thanks so much for that. Hannah Marsh from the Bureau of Meteorology. In the far west of New South Wales, the upper western will be partly cloudy. There's a medium chance of showers in the far east, but not much chance anywhere else. Winds getting up a bit in the morning. Overnight temperatures will fall to around 6, but the daytime temperatures will get to 18 degrees. The lower western will be partly cloudy with a medium chance of showers in the far east. Overnight temperatures will get down to 5, but during the day it'll reach about 17 degrees. More to come on the Country Hour as we approach 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hi, it's great to have you company. I am Cassie Huff, and soon you're going to meet some wine producers from one of Australia's most remote wine regions who are back on the road trying to make up for some of the downturn caused by the COVID restrictions. And if you've had trouble getting sunflower oil, you're not alone.
We did forecast there would be an increase in production. We have more than double the seed for this coming season that we had for the previous season, but still not enough for the demand that there is.
Lots of farmers across Australia are trying to fill the shortfall in sunflower production because Ukraine is usually a massive producer of sunflowers and sunflower oil. But it's not an easy crop to grow in South Australia because it's grown in summer when rainfall is low. But could it be worth a shot given the somewhat wet forecast with the La Nina watch? If you use sunflower oil in your business, deep frying or perhaps cooking with it, or perhaps you're thinking about growing sunflowers, call or text me. Call on 1300 222 891 or text 0467 922 891, because I'd be interested to know, is it harder to get oil, or are you actually thinking about taking a punt on growing sunflowers given the wet forecast? As I said, text 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. We'll find out what's making news, though, with the headlines from Matt Coleman. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie. The federal government ministers say that there are questions to answer over how the former Prime Minister appointed himself to multiple portfolios. It's been revealed that Scott Morrison separately took on the roles of Joint Health, Finance and Resources Ministers at various times while in office. While some ministers were told at the time, others did not know it was happening. The federal government is promising to crack down on rorting of the National Disability Insurance Scheme, which it says is partly responsible for the scheme's soaring costs. Concerns about fraud have prompted the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission Chief Michael Phelan to call for a new multi-agency task force to tackle the problem. The state government says it will look into providing school lunches for students at public schools. Flinders University researchers found the majority of parents want schools to provide lunch each day, and the Adelaide Zoo will be reviewing CCTV footage in the coming days to try to understand how Ravi the red panda escaped. The 7-year-old red panda broke out of his enclosure to a nearby park on Friday after only arriving at the zoo last week. That's the latest ABC News.
Thanks for that, Matt. Now, COVID threw up a range of issues for Australia's wine producers. Some benefited, some really struggled in the last 2 years to find markets. Now a group of Coonawarra winemakers are fighting for their share of a tight domestic market as imports of foreign wine increase. Megan Hughes has this story.
So what I've got in front of you here is, thought we'd show something a little bit different in the region, not super different, but not a red, so that's, I suppose, a little bit different for Coonawarra. We've got a rosé here, which is a Pinot grape that we use for this rosé. Just pour a little tasting. So you can see, yeah,
Angus nice. Smybert is a winemaker based in Coonawarra. He has a cellar door in the community, but is joining more than 24 local industry professionals, taking his wine to Australia's major cities. The Coonawarra Vignerons embark on a trip each year to sell their wines directly to customers by hosting wine tasting shows. It's been an annual tradition for more than a decade, as Executive Officer Ockett LaRue explains.
Yes, so the history of the roadshow event, which is what we normally sort of refer to as the cellar door in the city wine tasting event, that's been around for a fair bit. I think it started roughly about 2010. As far back as then, it started very small and then grew over time. So what happened in this instance is, the reason it started is, Coonawarra is probably one of the most remote wine regions in Australia. Many people think Margaret River is, But if you look at the geographics, Margaret River is about just under 3 hours away from Perth, where Coonawarra is a good four hours south of Adelaide, and it's a good 5 hours west of Melbourne. So we don't always get consumers visiting us, our region. If you look at Adelaide Hills and Barossa, which is within an hour away from the cities.
This is the first tour since the COVID-19 pandemic began, and the market has changed dramatically. Australian Grape and Wine CEO Tony Badaline says domestic production decreased in the past year, making room for imports.
The Australian domestic market is actually the biggest market for Australian wine. Everyone talks about our exports, but domestically is where most of our sales come from, and it's the predominant driver of wealth and profit for most of our businesses. So it's got about 40% of all Australian wine sales by volume. What we saw during COVID was that actually wine sales in Australia dropped. So there's a lot of mythology about actually wine sales increased. They didn't, they dropped. But that's been a trend that's happened about over the last 3 or 4 years at least, and probably a bit longer, that we're dropping 3 to 4% a year. So it's our most important market, but it's under a bit of pressure, and certainly has been over the last few years.
So Australians are not drinking as much wine as they used to?
No, that's right. And that reflects a worldwide trend. So globally, people are drinking less wine. Doesn't mean they're drinking less alcohol, though that seems to be the case as well. So people are moving to either healthier-based drinks or going to low and no alcohol products away from traditional alcohol categories. And I guess the other big thing is that domestically we've got imports which are growing and taking market share. So we need to get some of that market share back from those imports.
Where are these imports coming from?
So most of the imports are coming from France. So France is, it's increasing, and that's mainly champagne. So we're very big sparkling drinkers, particularly champagne. New Zealand, of course, is a very strong exported to Australia with Sauvignon Blanc. So it's a lot of white wine. But what we're seeing is Chile and Spain and some of those countries are really increasing their exports of red wine.
The Coonawarra region produces primarily red wine, Cabernet Sauvignon to be specific. A significant portion of that wine was sent to China before the tariff was introduced and trade effectively stopped, making this event more important than ever. Mr. Smybert has been involved in the roadshow since 2014. He says being part of this gives the winemakers direct access to their customers, which due to COVID-19 travel restrictions, they haven't really had.
From a profiling or branding point of view, I think it's really important. We're in a really competitive, particularly at the moment, even more so, quite a competitive industry. So being able to maintain that relationship with customers is really, really important. So this is sort of key to doing that, is maintaining our presence in consumers' minds, but also just the flow and effect of people seeing these events in media and social media. And it's really critical, particularly to promote visitation to the region. So we kind of, most people that are there, if they haven't been, we're often saying you should come along and trying to invite them to the region. So yeah, it's critical.
Coonawarra winemaker Angus Smybert ending that story from Megan Hughes. Now, last week, the Eyre Peninsula Desalination Plant Site Selection Committee recommended Sleaford West as the best place to house the desalination facility for Port Lincoln. The committee was tasked with finding an alternative site to the proposed Billy Lights Point, which has been suggested by SA Water following the aquaculture industry in Port Lincoln campaigning against that location due to the potential effects on marine life that called the area home. Environment and Water Minister Susan Close now has to look at this, and she spoke with Dylan Smith about what happens next.
The challenge is going to be working out what we can best afford given the constraints. While the new proposal for Sleaford West is absolutely one that clearly has a lot of community backing, it isn't one that's yet had a lot of detailed work done on exactly how much it's going to cost. That's because it's a new site that's been selected and therefore needs a bit more work to find out exactly how much it's going to cost to put a desalination plant there. The bigger challenge we have is that the base case, which is at Billy Lights Point, we know essentially how much that one is likely to cost. It's likely that that's the amount that ISCOSA will allow us to build and to charge all customers for. And anything more expensive than that, we're going to have to go find some money, and that isn't going to be easy.
Are a lot of works or, you know, tests going to have to be done out at Sleaford West now on site with infrastructure and, like you said, how much things are going to cost if it was to be built out there?
Yes, I think there's some on-site work that would need to be undertaken to make those assessments, but also the main additional cost is simply distance. The further you need to bring power out and the more you have to have pipes to take water back to the town, that's where the cost is going to be. And Sleaford West looks like a great site, you know, on paper. And when I had a look on the map and when I've been there in the past, it's a fair distance from Port Lincoln. So we can't overlook the significant additional cost that just that distance will cause, as well as we don't yet know much about the geology of that particular site and therefore whether there'd be any engineering challenges.
And how long do you think this process is going to take?
Port Lincoln and the Eyre Peninsula will be in some water strain by 2025. We need a desalination plant there in order to make sure that there is good quality and reliable water supply for the Eyre Peninsula. So we can't take 2 years to think this through. We can take a very few months. That's something that's going to also affect the ultimate decision about where we put this desal plant. It is necessary and we are utterly committed to doing it. We need to do it in a way that is environmentally sustainable, that is logistically sensible, and if possible, with as much community support as we can get.
Just going back to the cost side of things, you know, you said if it was to be built at Sleaford West, you would need to get some funding. Where do you go for that funding? Is it federally?
There is a federal bucket of money that is part of the National Water Initiative. Now, they will go through the same sort of process that ESCOSA goes through, which is to say, if you can do it cheaper somewhere else, why would we give you money to do it at a more expensive version further away? We have a good answer to that in very many ways, and that's why I'm grateful for the work that Peter Treloar has led and the community has been involved with. But it is likely to be a significant additional amount of money, and will that be sufficiently persuasive when the federal government will be asked to support other projects around the country that might have a simpler case to make?
Money is the major factor, but you've got to weigh up also the environmental costs as well, don't you?
I think what we're talking about here is something a little bit separate to that, which is the community licence. So we can have a scientific debate about the impact of brine and where it's discharged, but I think that there's challenge within the Port Lincoln community about where they would accept having a desalination plant. And that's a little bit about the environment and a little bit about the perception of the clean and green aquaculture and fishing industry, and a perception perhaps that that might be challenged by various locations. I believe in social license to do things. I believe that we should always seek to have a community be behind something that we do. And that's why I'm very happy that the committee has investigated this and has reported this. But we need to work through how much scientific rigour we can have sit underneath that to justify an alternative location, because all of that helps us then justify either ESCOSA allowing us to spend the money or being able to get money from the federal government.
Environment and Water Minister Susan Close speaking with Dylan Smith. And we'll follow that process as they work out what they're going to do about the desalination plant required for the Port Lincoln area. I'm Cassie Huff. It is 17 minutes to one.
The September issue of Gardening Australia magazine has all the inspiration you need to get planting. Read about rewilding, learn about hydroponics and propagating natives, and tips on how to grow perfect tomatoes. And in Organic Gardener, find practical solutions on how to grow your own and save, tips on achieving zero waste, and how to make mulch with your old jeans. Gardening Australia and Organic Gardener magazines, available from newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
I've heard some reporting this week about the skyrocketing price for cooking oils, particularly sunflower oil, which has been brought about by the war in Ukraine. So the question begs, why don't we grow and process our own? Well, there is some sunflower production in this country, not so much in this state. And as Luke Radford discovered, interest is growing around beefing up our local sunflower oil industry. But there are a few challenges along the way.
Cooking oil is big money. Globally, it's worth $186 billion. That's $30 billion more than the global wheat trade. And with the rise in demand for biodiesel, it's not slowing down anytime soon. But when Russia invaded Ukraine, the world's supply of sunflower oil, which is essential for industrial deep frying, was cut in half. and that's drawn the attention of Australia's Oilseed Federation and its CEO, Nick Goddard.
The opportunity to grow and increase the sunflower industry domestically is certainly there, and it's just been heightened over the last couple of months because of this global shortage and the high prices. So we're seeing renewed interest in returning to a sunflower industry in Australia. The opportunity is certainly there to increase sunflower production for this year. The challenge is always to know how much seed the seed producers need to produce, because if your Ukraine situation eases over the next 12 months, and let's hope it does, and life returns to normal, well, then we'll return to more normal global supply and demand for sunflower oils.
And it's not just theoretical interest. Chris Hare is the Northern Breeding Manager with Barron Brugg Australia, which produces sunflower crop seed at Toowoomba in southern Queensland. He says their seed for this year has completely sold out.
We did forecast there would be an increase in production. We have more than double the seed for this coming season that we had for the previous season, but still not enough for the demand that there is. We have orders for all the seed that we have in stock, and we also have a contra-season production up north, which is planted a bit later. But again, we have forecast estimates on what the amount of that seed is, but we also don't know if it will meet specs in terms of germination percentage, etc. But we also have orders in for the majority of what we forecast that will be already as well.
So there's massive demand this year globally, and growers are keen to grow it. So what's preventing Australia from supersizing the sunflower oil industry? Well, first, there's uncertainty. Producing the seed for the crop requires a massive lead time of almost a year, which leaves the industry vulnerable if global conditions change. Here's Chris Hare again.
In terms of actually providing seed to the market, we have to do our production a year in advance. They're all hybrid seeds that we sell, so you need to do a cross between two parents to produce that seed. So we need to do that in advance, which means to have seed ready for 2023-24 season, we need to be making a decision now about how much we'll need and planting that in probably October. The Ukraine thing, no one had that crystal ball. So, or at least maybe Russia did, but no one else did. That's made it difficult. We don't know what's going to happen with the Ukrainian war. We know that there'll be limitations as to how much they can produce, harvest, move. Even if the war were to end now, I think it's unlikely that things would get back to normal within 12 months. So we're hoping that we might be able to talk to some of the end users, etc., to see if they can give us some commitment.
One of the other issues is the economics. While valuable, in most of Australia's sunflower-growing regions, it just can't compete on a price basis with other crops. Sam O'Rafferty is an agronomist with Summit Ag in the New South Wales Riverina.
It's typically not really our fit, particularly in southern New South Wales. Our irrigation systems tend to be high input, in my experience. You can't tend to save your way to a profit. Cotton will go round it on return per hectare 9 years out of 10, probably, or in most circumstances, unless you got really bad root disease, cotton root disease, black root rot, and Pythium and Rhizoctonia, where your yield potential is limited. In your cotton production system, sunflowers certainly have a fit, and that's one avenue that we've really been pushing it down. But yeah, cotton is definitely going to outcompete it on a per hectare yield basis most of the time.
That being said, there's a window where sunflowers could prove a valuable part of Australia's cropping industry, and that's during drought years.
Work on 5 megalitres per hectare in a budget, as opposed to cotton uses 10. So I'd say they're going to compete with the corn area a lot harder on a fallow scenario. Just being half the water input and half the fertiliser program, a shorter growing season and far less tonnes to handle. So it's fewer storage and grain logistics, which is all the cost to your business as well. We haven't really seen it on a big scale in lower input years. So that's when it might come into its own, when we can grow it on later water allocation. If you get some water in November or December and decide to whack it in into fallow and run it, yeah, on a base program.
But there is one last challenge. There's not enough production capacity at the moment to create the oil, but Chris Hare believes there's an opportunity to change that.
It's certainly the best opportunity we've had for 5 or more years, in that, you know, a few things are lining up in its favour. So even taking Ukraine out of the scenario, just with freight and logistics issues that have been happening over the last 12 to 18 months has already caused a few issues. So it would be nice to think that as a, you know, whole industry, we could get together somehow and try to provide a level of consistency at least, so that end users knew they were able to source some oil from domestic production. Crushers knew that they would have a certain amount to crush each year, and we'd have, you know, a reasonable commitment that there'd be a certain amount of seed required, and growers, you know, the same, would know that there's a demand out there for what they produce.
Doesn't sound like Australia will be taking over from Ukraine anytime soon when it comes to sunflower production. But Chris Hare, the Northern Breeding Manager with Barenberg Australia there, which produces sunflower crop seed in southern Queensland, spoke with Luke Radford there about some of the opportunities that could present themselves. And I was speaking with some farmers in Queensland recently as well, and they are looking at growing more sunflowers, as was mentioned there. It's not easy to ramp up production in South Australia given the lack of processing capacity and lack of summer rain as well. But if you're interested in perhaps giving it a go, text me 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. I'm also interested to know on the consumer side of this, have you been noticing an increasing cost when it comes to cooking oils, particularly sunflower oil? Again, as I said, text me 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. It's 10 to 1.
It's National Science Week, right across the ABC.
What's your favourite Aussie tree?
One that's great to climb.
Or maybe it's the sound and smell of home.
On ABC TV, join me, Anne Jones and Paul West for a Catalyst special.
Comparing the unique beauty and science of Australia's iconic trees.
And you can vote for your favourite too.
Science Week on ABC Listen, ABC TV and ABC iView. Find out more at abc.net.au/scienceweek.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Greening Australia has registered for the largest ever Australian reforestation carbon aggregation. They're teaming up with the Clean Energy Regulator, which will see more than 500,000 native trees planted across an area 220 times the size of the Melbourne cricket ground in September this year. Now, in Australia, this project is taking place at four sites along from the Coorong National Park to the South Australian Murray Mallee, and that is going to cover about 1,000 hectares of native vegetation reforestation. So a lot of hands are going to be involved in that, I can imagine. Director of Commercial Development at Greening Australia, Jay Van Ryan, spoke with Dylan Smith about the program and what they're hoping to see in the future.
Bringing nature back to the landscape using environmental market. We're really proud that this year we've been able to register Australia's largest environmental planting aggregation, and that'll see 546,000 trees go back into the landscape where they weren't before. And those trees and the supporting infrastructure that will keep them in the ground is being funded through the Australian carbon market and the carbon finance associated with that.
How many participants are involved in this initial program?
This year, we have 7 landholders who are participating in this aggregation. The landholders are located in New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia and Western Australia. And 5 of those 7 landholders are Australian farmers who are using the land for a productive purpose and have seen the opportunity of bringing native trees back to their property and receiving the carbon finance that's associated.
You mentioned the farmers there, and you mentioned the carbon credit finances as well that they get back. How much do they get back, or is it differing to landholder to landholder?
It does vary from site to site, and that's purely based on the site economics. So there is a carbon price out there that we are responding to, and each site needs to be measured against the viability of that carbon price. And ultimately what we want to do is have a proposition to landholders where they want to have the trees into their landscape so that they get the benefits of those trees coming into the landscape, and through the evaluation of their site, that the remuneration that the carbon market can support is also beneficial to them. So we're always having a discussion with the landholders about where are the trees best in the property, how can they help support the broader use of the property, and do we have a price that's going to make that work. So we're always open to that discussion, and really ultimately we want to be able to provide as much remuneration back to the landholders as the market price can tolerate.
And when was the first, you know, kind of aggregation started? Was it a couple of years ago?
Early 2008 timeline was sort of the first. That was really at the very beginnings of the carbon market. And what's happened though since is it really hasn't done anything for the last 10 years. And this is just in part due to net zero commitments, both at the government and corporate level, not really being that widely supported. And there's been no investment into this space until very recently. And really, it's been the last 2 years that that investment has come. And it's not a cheap exercise, restoring land. Green Australia has been doing it for 40 years. And it's been doing it mostly from grants and philanthropy to bring native vegetation back to the landscape. And really, in the last 2 years, we've finally got a market signal to be able to do this at scale using private money through the carbon market. So what we're finding now is building. We're really at the start of a very exciting future, being able to do carbon aggregation through reforestation at scale. And we're looking forward to next year being even bigger than this year.
What type of species is Greening Australia planting on these sites? Is it different at each site?
Yeah, every site has to, under the method that the regulator has published. When we're doing environmental planting, every site has to have representative native vegetation going back. So really what that means is vegetation was there before the land was cleared, and that's the vegetation that we're putting back. There's a fantastic good news story, in particular on the Eyre Peninsula in South Australia, where recently the drooping she-oak grassy woodland community was listed as critically endangered under our National Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Act. And it just so happens that's exactly the community that we've been, that vegetation community that we've been restoring for several years on the Eyre Peninsula. And now we're in a place where the carbon projects are facilitating the restoration of what is now a critically endangered, I should say, vegetation community. So that's just a good news story that we're seeing the policy shift to protect that community, and we're seeing the market arrive to be able to fund it. And with that, we're able to also provide habitat to really iconic species in the area, such as the white-bellied sea eagle and the mallyfowl, who all visit those communities in the local Ramsar wetlands as well.
It's not just about planting more or replanting and revegetating more native species. It's also about what's connected to that, you know, bringing wildlife back to the area as well.
Absolutely. You know, at the end of the day, we want to be able to build the homes for the biodiversity to move into. So it's about creating that connectivity between areas. And so it's great to have restoration to the landscape, but it's even better when we can start to connect remnant vegetation and increase corridors to enable those flora and fauna species to move through those new established areas.
Dylan Smith speaking with the Director of Commercial Development at Greening Australia, Jay Van Ryan. And that project that's particularly taking place in South Australia between the Coorong National Park and the Murray Mallee is looking at restoring the habitat for threatened species like the mallyfowl and the migratory shorebirds. So it sounds like there's a lot of work to be done. I think there's about 1,000 hectares of native vegetation and wildlife habitat that they're looking at reforesting. So big job ahead in September for Greening Australia. That's about all we have time for in the program, but Sonia Feldoff will join you later this afternoon on your local radio. Good afternoon. We haven't seen each other for a while.
We haven't. It's been a while. How are you, Cassie?
I'm well, thanks.
The fact is that at the moment there's a lot of discussion about teachers, and in particular the teacher shortage. And a lot of people might be asking, why would you bother getting into the teaching profession at the moment? It's just too hard. Well, I've got a story today all the way from Port Lincoln that will, I think, answer that question and make you realise that that very special teacher-student bond makes the hard work worthwhile. It's such a delightful story. I can't wait to share it with you after 1:30 today. Also, of course, still in the schools, autism is... Oh, excuse me.
Sonia's having a bit
I'm
of
actually
going
to die on my own. autism has obviously caused some, brings lots of different behaviours and all of that sort of things. And suddenly there's a new priority and focus that's coming to South Australia with that new Minister for Autism. We're going to see how it might play out in schools and bring you some of that. Plus, we're going to the Stars with Brad Tucker, so lots happening on the show today.
Oh, good, because I understand that's the first, we're the first state to have someone specifically dedicated to autism.
Yeah, now, I mean, this is not just in schools, but we're going to take a look at the impact it might have in schools. I think the Minister for Autism will be guiding our focus and policy here in South Australia more generally, but it's obviously one of the big areas where this might play out, and there's resourcing behind it to see teachers get the skills to help kids in that way, and that's in many people's view a good thing. But there are lots of other conditions out there, and some are saying, well, what about us?
Absolutely. Well, keep listening to ABC local radio. You'll catch Sonia on 891 next, but the regional stations will head to the world today first. But that's about all we have time for on the Country Hour. If you'd like to find out what's happening in rural news, go online to abc.net.au/rural. Also, if you want to catch up, we podcast every day. Just go to where you find your podcasts or search for the South Australian Country Hour, and there we'll be. Do take a listen. It's great to catch up sometimes on stories that you might have missed. But right now, it's coming up to 1 o'clock. Time for news.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.